Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're here for night number two of the scheduled presentation for budget request. Before we get to assessment, there was an article in the newspaper this morning talking about tax rebates, tax caps, STAR money, all kinds of things. It seemed a little bit confusing, and my question to the county administrator and his question to me was, he would like a chance to explain all about tax caps and rebate checks that may or may not be coming. So, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, put aside everything you read in the article, because that it's if it was true, it was so confusing, it's really not meaningful. When we began this process, I said that the tax cap for next year is still there. There's still a state tax cap on how much the levy can go up. But the consequence of not achieving the cap is no longer that you lose the potential of getting a rebate for homeowners. That rebate program ended for the 2016 tax year. So we hit it last year. You recall we came in under the cap, and therefore that satisfied one of the two tests for the rebate. The second test for the rebate was that we submitted an acceptable government efficiency plan. You remember all that. So we had to satisfy both tests to qualify folks for a rebate check that related to the 2016 budget that would be received sometime over the course of this year. We ended up satisfying both of those tests. You passed a budget that was underneath the tax cap. And with TCOG, we presented a government efficiency plan that met the state's test. You recall that. So whatever else you took out of the article, including does the rebate program extend for another year and does 2017 play into that? The answer is no, it doesn't. It's over. It ended last year. And then the second question is, do our taxpayers, are they entitled to a rebate check based on what you did last year? The answer to that question is yes. So those are the two simple things to keep in mind as you look through that otherwise very confusing article about all of these things that relate to the tax cap program.
That's a story, and we're sticking to it. One short question, really. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I thought it was a clear explanation.
Isn't the receipt by our residents of the rebate dependent on what their municipality and school district did as well?
No, if it how much they get depends on that, but their county tax they get at least credit for what you did with the county tax levy last year. Okay. If the city and the district did it state under as well, then they can get more money from those governments.
And for the upcoming year, if the state still tells us what our cap is supposed to be, but there are no consequences, what difference does it make if we go over it?
Well, the consequence is probably more of a political consequence than a monetary consequence. You still need a supermajority to approve the budget, but that's
not. I meant budgetary. I understand there's political decisions. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
One short announcement. You realized the other evening that the district attorney postponed his time here, and he will be here at the end of this process. So right now, it's assessment time. Jay, you're on. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having us here. Thanks, Joe, for giving the introduction of what my office has been trying to explain on a hourly basis, if not more, to the general public on this. So here's our first slide, showing last year's budget and the recommended budget. There's a net change of $150,000, with most of that coming in one-time over-target requests that the county administrator has recommended. Our major influences are pretty much the same as they have been in the past. Our work is dictated, most of it, by what happens within the real estate market. It's kind of hard for us to know what's going to happen next year within the real estate market. If I could tell you that, I'd be a developer and I wouldn't be sitting here right now. But our staff has been reduced down to pretty much the bare minimum at 11.5 FTEs coming up. You'll see a slide further on. We're back in 1999. We're up to 19 full-time equivalents. So we've pretty much gone down to that bare minimum, and it's simply based upon the people that I have in my office. You know, I have Irene Keo, Al Fiorelli, Michael Zyroth, just real quality appraisers who can juggle multiple tasks at once and do jobs of multiple people. Tammy and JC in my front office, to go from 7 front office staff to 2 just shows what they can do serving the public and also actually getting something done. But I'm not exactly sure how they did that. They were both out of the office today. Irene and I were in the front office, and we're unequipped to be answering phone calls and helping out there. So, and we do have an aging workforce. Sorry, Irene. But coming down the pipeline, we will need to replace these quality individuals. And, you know, there's not high school, college programs to become an appraiser. So it does take time to come into our office, learn the ropes, and be able to be a full contributing member. Unfortunately, another influence we have is the New York State Legislature and their constant passing of legislation for checks and changing programs. You know, we have the tax cap rebate checks that'll come out for the last time this fall. This will be the 3rd year in a row. The STAR registration process that they did back in 2013, everybody had to re-register with New York State. Great program, but they dropped the ball. For any new homeowners in 2014 and 2015, they never had to register with New York State. So any unintentional fraud that kind of crept in the system has crept in the system again. But they couldn't do that because of all the rebate checks that came out. There's the new STAR income tax credit check. All of you are aware that they took the STAR exemption and decided rather than sending the 15 checks that they do to the school districts, it's better to send 700 checks to property owners within Tompkins County. We're taking phone calls constantly on that now that all the rural school district tax bills are out there. And when are we going to get our checks? Do I have to put up $600 and hopefully get that check back? But allegedly, the state will mail those out by the end of the month. There's the new STAR refund check that's coming out this year, $185. That'll slowly be phased in for another 3 years. So that should be coming out shortly before November. That will be combined with the tax cap rebate checks if something in that article was correct. I'm on a weekly phone call to talk about some of these checks and how to administer it, and we've never discussed combining the STAR rebate check with the tax cap rebate checks. And I almost feel like I need a cheat sheet to keep track of all of the different names and when the program came in and when it's going to expire. And I can pretty much guarantee you next year in 2017 we'll have a new session check coming out of it, or a new change to the STAR program when they need another $100 million to say they're not spending but not receiving in revenue. Something else will change to the STAR program. I can pretty much guarantee that. Seems like I became a little cynical in my 20 years here in the office. Apologize for that. Another major influence we have, if you haven't looked around and see the cranes, a wise old man in my office always said you can tell how well an economy's doing if you count the number of cranes that you can see on the out there in the air. But, you know, we have a lot of new construction averaging over the last 4 years. You know, we have 150 new homes, 230 new apartments. I kind of keep a little tickler of all of the proposed apartments and number of beds. There's about 2,000 proposed units and 3,500 proposed beds in various projects and various stage of construction, proposal, announcement. And that doesn't include Herald Square. Emerson's, our new municipality that they're planning out there, and all of Cornell's East Hill Plaza plans, past the first Maplewood, whatever that. Those three are kind of hit and miss on what's going to happen. Seems like we have about 30 new hotels each year. Maybe that's a little exaggeration, but you know there is a significant number of hotels going up. Each year we add about $127 million of new lumber, that part of that tax cap growth that we have. You know, it seems like a day doesn't go by where either myself or Al doesn't take a call from some developer wanting to come into Tompkins County to, you know, they have a new idea for student housing, a new senior living project. So we definitely have the attention of the rest of the country on where people want to be when they're looking to develop. Another influence we have, solar will be my new headache this next year. Just so many complex issues that involve solar projects that the real property tax law is not keeping up with. There's projects out there where the panels are not on your house, but they're on the solar farm, and you have your own individual meter. It's almost like if they're on your house. If we're not seeing value being added to panels that are on someone's house simply because they're located off-site, do they have value? If they do, who should they be assessed to? The owner of the land, the master leaseholder, or the lease of each individual unit? I don't want to create 40 new sub-accounts on land. I know Rick wouldn't be too happy if someone goes delinquent and we try to foreclose on three solar panels. So there's a lot of issues there. You know, there's three different farm systems that are set up. We met with Renovis last week. And they're very complex issues that the real property tax law just doesn't want to mend to. We have to deal with pilots. We are in the exemption. We can require a pilot, but the mechanics of having that happen is something we're trying to work out with towns and school districts. Net lease sales. There's more accounting that comes into play nowadays. You know, our assessments are 100% fair market value. What your assessment is what you should be able to sell your property for. Well, BJ's sold last year for $16.8 million. It cost about $9 million to construct. But the only reason it sold for $16.8 million is if you had a grade A tenant in with a 15-year lease. They're paying more than if BJ's went out, you know, kind of the big box dark store theory, and we're struggling with how to value accounting tricks. The same way drug stores. CVS just sold for $4.1 million. If it wasn't a CVS and Verizon went into it, similar to what happened where Verizon store is, it's worth the $1.7 million that we have on it. So we can't just take sales as the word anymore. We have to dig deeper in and find out if it's a 1031 exchange, find out what sort of allocation. Three gas stations sold within the county at a much higher rate than what we would have thought they did, but a lot of that's and accounting and the business value is inherent within those sale prices. So it's just the we wear much more hats than what we used to in the past. And then one of the big things we have to deal with is all of the real property tax exemptions. There was a study done by the Assessors Association, and that takes 52% of the assessor's time, processing senior exemptions, ag land exemptions, updating ownership, maintaining records of it. The work that JC and Tammy do processing the bulk of these exemptions is absolutely amazing to be able to handle that. So here's the slide I promised. I always have to add, you know, 2000, we were at 19 FTEs. We went to 15, bottomed out at 10, and been holding steady at 11.5. In 2015, it shows 12.5. We did have that extra person. We never actually hired them because our planned retirement of our commercial valuation specialist that was supposed to happen in 2013 still hasn't happened yet. So at some point, hopefully he'll retire and be able to enjoy his partial retirement. So our first over target request for one-time money for $95,000 that the county administrator recommended is to implement a digital sketch program. Since 1997, when I started, we've constantly looked at a digital sketch program. We've never actually gone with it. But I think the time is right to become like most other assessing units. Tompkins County is always looked at as the leader within the assessment community, and everyone kind of chuckles when I say we don't have a digital sketch program. That's not the only reason to do it, because everyone else is, but you know, looking at how it could help the rest of the county by being able to geo-reference these property sketches for use in 911 to be able to update our building footprints. We can remove our 6 asbestos fire-safe filing cabinets that we have out back and move them somewhere else would be great. We'll be able to update these sketches from the field through our tablets. And then moving on, we'll be able to use Change Finder whenever we do a new flyover. So those places off the road that we don't go driving down the long driveways anymore, I'll be able to see if something changed without a building permit. You know, Joe asked, is this going to make your office more efficient? And I said, no, it's probably going to make us less efficient. But I think in the short term, we'll be less efficient. Overall, it'll be maybe something neutral. But for the public and for other county departments, I think it would be much more efficient. It's similar to our digital tax maps. If I had my own way and I lived in a tunnel, we'd still do paper tax maps. But as they're used for everybody else, sorry, Greg, for cringing there, but as the basis for our whole GIS system, we're able to put in that extra time to benefit the rest of the county. Yeah, I'm not touching that.
We didn't hear that. What was that question?
Eventually.
The second over target request that was funded is another one-time money for an RPTL 520 database. Real Property Tax Law Section 520 says you shall remove exemptions when a non-eligible buyer buys a piece of property and then the pro rata taxes are then calculated. So if a not-for-profit sold a property today, we would have to calculate from today's date through December 31st the 2016 county taxes that they would then be responsible for, and that would be a pro rata tax. The school taxes would then be calculated from today's date until June 30th for their fiscal year. That percentage would then be placed on the next year's tax bill. This decision was made long before me to not administer this, even though the law says shall. We've kind of administer it somewhat. If a property sold today to a non-exempt owner, I would make it taxable for the next tax bill. So rather than being subject to a tax from today till December 31st, they would just become taxable on the 2017 town and county tax bill. It's not perfect. It works somewhat, but it's still not in compliance with what the real property tax law says we shall do. Way back when we looked at it, it's at least a half-time position to manually calculate this out. There's databases that are out there now that'll let us punch in a couple pieces of information and have it upload into our state database. So I think for a small one-time fee, that's a good thing to come into compliance with what the law says you shall do. Our one over-target request that was not recommended, included in our base budget, is an administrative assistant level one at 35 hours. This will provide us with three office staff positions. So on a day like today when life happens, hopefully Irene and I won't have to spend all of our day out in the front office answering phones, and one of us would just cover that person's lunch. This over-target request is just to go from 35 to 40 hours. Our crunch time within the office, you know, is lunch and the beginning of the day and the end of the day when people are more likely to take off. So we would just be missing on occasion that time when one or two of our office staff are out during that time. But I think that's it.
Okay, I have questions. I have Anna and Peter and Carol. Anna, go ahead. And Martha.
Yeah, thank you. One question. You were talking about STAR, and I've heard so many headaches and people trying to figure it out and the whole difficulty that you were describing. Overall, how many extra hours do you think it has added to your workload to handle the changes that the government, the state, put into the STAR system?
From the beginning, it's at least a one FTE processing all of the STAR exemptions, the enhanced STAR exemptions. This change this year, there's some time that's has been reduced because we don't have to send out new applications, but we're removing people. We're answering more phone calls. So if you know, a small amount of time has been added, you know, if, you know, I probably have 2 hours a week that I'm answering STAR related questions, mm-hmm. or those questions get passed up to me from an angry property owner who now has a higher tax bill. And at some point, we'll hopefully get a check from the state.
So all with everybody put together, it's probably one FTE. And do you expect that to go down over the next couple of years, or do you?
It should go down if nothing else changes. Okay. Back up until 2008 or 9, the state actually used to reimburse us $1 per parcel for that cost, which pretty much covered that added work.
And they don't?
But then in 2008, when the economy crumbled across the state, that's when they took away that state aid. You know, we used to receive about $170,000 worth of state aid per year, which was a good three office staff positions. And then that was taken away when the reassessment aid went away and the STAR aid went away. The work never went away, though.
Thanks.
Peter.
Boy, there was one number there that really caught my attention and made me say, wow, and open up my eyes. And that was that in 10 years, you've dropped from 19 FTEs to 10 FTEs, if I read it right.
Yep.
Right?
Yes, and now we're slowly back up to 11 and a half.
Okay. All right, well, I mean, is that good or is that bad? I wondered, on the one side, that's great. You know, you're doing more work with less people. Certainly the amount of work hasn't gone down. It's surely gone up. But then secondly, or is this all to do with automation, in which case we're losing 10 jobs? So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
We're doing the same amount of work, you're right. We have become more automated, but I have a great staff. And they're the reason that we're able to cut office staff positions, cut some appraisers, and they can juggle work. Michael Zyroth is our valuation specialist. He also does mapping. So he's juggling two tasks. Once some of these people start to retire, then we're going to have to ramp back up. Because there's no way that I'm going to replace Irene Keough with one person. That there isn't one person that can do her job. I can't do her job.
Okay, well, that's all positive then. Thanks.
Carol, Martha, Mike.
So I have two questions. Is it legal? I'm not sure what the implications would have to be. I have to think about this, but I didn't see any listing for fees. It's on the exemption requests. You said it was taking a significant amount of staff to process all the requests for exemptions each year. Is it legal? Is it something that you would want us to think about a decision in the future about whether we ought to charge some kind of fee to process such a request?
No, I mean, the exemption is for a break on someone's taxes, so to charge someone to get a break just seems a little more, you know, there are areas when someone asks for an estimate of value, you know, when a developer comes in and, you know, I've had one project be revised four times now, and the amount of time it takes me to provide the letter that they need to their lending institution, you know, that's something that maybe we could look at. You know, is that really a free service to come up with an estimate of a proposed project?
Right. Well, I'd be open to hearing about that. And then the other one was the solar, the work that it's taking your office to process or to think about the solar assessment value, assessed values. Refresh my memory on whether we ever exempted that. And not asking for it now, but it would be, I'd be interested in seeing at some point a breakdown of what size solar installations take the bulk of your time. So if you took somebody's own personal rooftop versus some large industrial installation, I'd be interested in seeing that and then thinking in the future about whether we ought to consider exemptions for that kind of thing. So have we ever had?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're currently in the exemption that's offered from 487. We went out, I think, in 2013 and came back in 2015. As it currently stands, the town of Enfield and the town of Lansing is out of the exemption. Ithaca City School, Lansing School, and Dryden School are out of the exemption. We still have to value it because even if they were in a municipality, say, the town of Newfield. Newfield offers at Newfield School, Tompkins County, but it's still taxable for Newfield Fire District taxes. There's no exemption for special districts. And the bulk of the projects are the 50 kilowatt or greater, the real somewhat commercial enterprise. And one of the big reasons why is the State Office of Real Property Tax Services doesn't really exist anymore. In the 1980s, they had 680 people on staff. They maybe have 100 people now. It seems like every week for the last 5 years, somebody was retiring, and they're replaced by a generic email address. So the state hasn't provided that guidance of here is how you value it. Here's all of the credits that come into play. Here's how we recommend you place it on the assessment roll. Even some basic questions regarding pilots when you're in the exemption are kind of going unanswered by the state. So we're kind of on it on our own, you know, talking to other assessors, other real property tax directors without really a good guidance from the state coming down.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you about that further. So it does sound like I'm not successfully finding you any ways to either increase fees or reduce a little bit of work. So it's
Martha.
So on the solar, a few years back, you had indicated you didn't have enough data to value, like, rooftop on a house solar as having added value. Does it now? Have you seen enough sales to where you're seeing that there is value? Or
No, there's still not a lot of sales. I think the last count I had, there was about 12 sales, and we haven't seen those causing a positive to value or negative for that fact. But, you know, if there is, you know, you're looking at a $2,000 change on a $250,000 house. $250 and $252 is the same value. We're good. We're not that good when you're looking at market value. So even if we did see something of that magnitude, you can't pick it up. It's like adding a deck to the house. It's nice. It may make it sell faster, but probably not sell for any more than without the deck.
Okay, so what you're really talking about is the larger installations, and especially complicated when you've got remote installations that are tied back to somebody else's account.
Correct.
I see.
Yeah, or to multiple accounts and how quickly that account could be transferred, even if the house was sold or if they wanted to move it to a different off-site location.
Okay. That's understandable. That's confusing. When you said digital property sketches, you mean where you have a piece of property and you'll have the little outline of the building and the barn and the whatever, you know, that kind of stuff? And that's right now, you're not, that's not digital?
No, right now we still get our pencil out and ruler and our graph paper and do it the same way, you know, my dad did it in 68. We're still using some of his sketches, oddly enough. You know, buildings don't grow, unlike the state thinks they do. But, this would then take it into a vector file, which would easily be able to be integrated in any geo-reference software. And it is digital, but it's a piece of paper we scan in and make it digital now.
Okay, so is this $95,000 for the software itself, or is it for software plus time to get somebody to move you into that system?
Yeah, the big bulk of it is converting all of our 26,000 sketches into the digital format. We didn't want to maintain two separate softwares to slowly convert over the next 30 years. So if we're going to do it, we're going to go ahead and maintain one system.
Okay. All right. And then you mentioned that you have developers call every week or so. Can you send them to the planning department? I mean, they're calling to say where's a good place to build and that sort of thing?
Yep. I mean, we have hotel, apartment people coming, you know, constantly, or we're going to look at this project. How are you guys going to look to value this property? You know, we're talking to a town now, but we may move to this other town because we're not sure of what the rules are with town A. You know, that's probably the biggest complaint we hear from developers daily is there is a very fluid set of rules on what can be built and what can and what could be built within zoning isn't necessarily what would be approved.
Okay, and just one more question. You have housing starts on that same slide. It said average last 4 years. Is that, do you mean over the last 4 years you've averaged 150 new homes a year? Or was that for 4 years?
No, that's 150 homes per year, 230 apartments per year.
Okay. Okay.
Mike.
Great, thank you very much.
Mike.
On the FTEs back in 2000, isn't part of that larger number, didn't that have to do with the reval and ramping up the number of employees back then?
Some of that, but it's the same work we're doing today. Since we're not part of the annual reassessment program, you know,
back then we were on a 10-year cycle. We hadn't revalued for 10 years at that point. Is that right?
Well, yeah.
Dan and Anna. Go ahead, Dan.
I have two questions. The first one was your OTR seeking to increase one of your staff's hours from 35 to 40. Does that person want to go up in hours?
That person is out looking for a job now, and hopefully we'll be able to start our interviewing and recruitment process and be able to hire that person. So I don't know if they want to work 35 or 40 hours.
You expect, if it was approved, to be a new person coming in?
Correct. Yeah, it will be. I don't have that person in the office.
Thank you. My other question or thought, I guess, is about the Board of Assessment Reviews that happen in each town. And I agree with you. Your staff is great. I love working with them. I always get very, you know, positive answers and help, very helpful. And I've asked every one of them, like, do you think this is a valuable use of time? And I've asked you, and you all say yes. But it seems to me that when you're talking about so much work and so few staff, that there's a lot of hours invested in that process to send your staff out to all those towns for half a day to each one. And, you know, the truth is that those board of assessments, those boards don't actually have the authority to change anyone's assessment. They make recommendations. So I just wanted to put the idea out there again that that would be a place that I would look for savings in the amount of work that you have to do and better use of your staff time.
You should probably talk to Glenn with how active we are out in Groton. I think that side, that town, would have a different opinion. And, you know, it is very important for us to create as many avenues for people to be able to have their assessment reviewed. And we are looking at changing how those Board of Assessments review act and what they can do and try to better train them, so to speak. So kind of stay tuned, and hopefully we'll be able to make that a little more worthwhile.
Are we down here? We're running long on this one. Anna, go ahead.
You were talking about your current staff and how they're kind of doing three or four jobs. There was a couple things that stuck out to me. One, how efficient they are and amazing they are at their jobs, which is fabulous. And the other is that there's no formal training. That really the only training, in a way, it sounds like, is to apprentice to an existing good appraiser. Is that true? Is that accurate to say?
Pretty much. You know, in order to become an appraiser, you know, you kind of have to start off. For me, I started off as a data collector. Pretty much, if you can breathe and write and walk, you can get about. You can become a data collector. So you do kind of have to start up and ramp your way up.
And the reason I ask is because I tend to think long term. And so one of the things that would be unfortunate is if these amazing people left, and then we hired replacements. Do you have any thoughts about succession plans, about trying to hire people who can train under them so that maybe possibly they would gain some of the efficiency at a faster rate because of that training?
That's why I'm hoping to ramp up in 3 to 4 years. They're not going to retire in 3 to 4 years. I'm hoping 7, 8 years down the line.
That's my last question.
Actually, in 2019 scares me. And the reason for that is in every other town, the assessor is appointed for a 6-year term. In October 1 of 2019, that's when all of the new reappointments are going to take place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't an issue to Tompkins County, but in 2019, a lot of the current assessors are going to be retiring across the state. So there's going to be a lot of openings, and hopefully none of my people want to take advantage of some of those openings. So that's something that I'm looking off into the future there.
Julie.
When I was considering getting off-site solar, I called my insurance company because the contract indicated clearly that in this particular contract, Renovus would not hold you harmless if something happened to your particular panels on their site. And my insurance company said, absolutely not. It's not on the site of your home. We would not consider adding it to your homeowners. So when you're talking about how to assess it, I think the fact that it's not, insurance companies don't look at this in a friendly way is a problem, too.
Thanks for adding one more issue that I got to look into. Appreciate that.
Anyone else? Last one.
Yeah, I just thought 2019 might scare you because those triplets are going to college soon. Is that...
Yeah, no, not yet. They're just in first grade. And
first grade, okay.
I got to get home to start on homework already, so.
Thank you very much, Jay. Excellent job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Weights and Measures, Don Ellis.
Good evening, everyone. This might be a little longer than previous years because I actually have put in for an OTR this year. My recommended budget, or my requested budget, was for a full-time person and all the additional equipment and training and all sorts of stuff like that that goes along with it. It's been Joe has recommended a part-time person. The only concern I have with a part-time person is if they're going to be sticking around for a long time. Because it takes quite a bit of time, like Jay was saying, for training new people. And if they're only going to be here for 6 months or a year and a half, they're not going to be here long enough to take over when I retire. And this is sort of like my succession plan, trying to get somebody trained, affiliated with all the contacts that I have, with state and local, and get somebody up to speed, I should say. The major influences are the increase in job duties that I'm unable to complete right now. There's some weights and measures jobs that I'm not able to do, and also some other side duties, the microbeads, some of the other stuff. And like I said, this is primarily for development of a successor to take over when I retire or to cover when I'm off on leave, so there's somebody around to answer phones and get out and do any emergency work. So the full-time equivalents as it stands for the recommended would be 1.5 for next year, up from 1 this year. That slide's been changed since I saw it. yes, like I said, my requested OTR was for a full-time person and all the stuff I need for them, with laptop, training, travel, and all that sort of stuff. And it has been recommended for a half-time person.
Mike and Dooley and Martha and Carol. Go ahead, Mike.
I mean, that just seems like a lot for a starting
salary. Use a mic, would you, please?
That just seems like a lot for a starting salary for somebody.
Well, it's more than just salary. It's a laptop, computer software, training, travel and training, extra fuel for the extra vehicle.
Fringe benefits.
What's the base salary then, I guess?
For a full-time person, the
Section 4, page 274. Maybe elsewhere.
Full-time salary would be $47,370 for the inspector. Half-time would be
$23,685. Dooley?
Okay. When I looked at your requirements on the same page for this additional person, I did not see another vehicle listed.
No, because I'm hoping to find a used vehicle from one of the other departments that they might be getting rid of. I don't plan on getting a brand new one. So that would have to be something that I might have to take out of an OTR or my rollover next year, because there's going to be a lot of time where we're going to be traveling together, so, because I'm going to be training them. So I didn't feel I needed the extra vehicle right away.
Martha, Carol, Peter.
So I guess at page 274, as Carol said, does outline the one-time versus the target increases. So there are certain expenses that whether somebody's working 10 hours a week or 40, you have to pay for the laptop and all. So,
right. That's why I did the one time. It'd be the laptop and the computer software.
Okay. And the training, is that ongoing, or is that Target?
That would be Target. Actually, training is Target. It's ongoing because we have a week-long school up in Syracuse that everybody's invited to go to. Plus, we have three other day-long meetings that we go to, so that would be okay. Under the travel and training.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Carol.
So, can you tell us something about the way that your duties, the ways in which the number of places you have to go out and inspect? What's the work that justifies having another whole person?
Actually, any business that conducts trade, anything from Walmart, the big businesses, big box stores, right down to a little produce stand. We have.
How many a year did you
right
do
now
20 years ago versus now?
The number of businesses are somewhat close to the same. I have roughly 300, and I don't have that figure with me, but around 350 to 400 businesses that I test with just devices. There's a lot of other businesses that I don't do package checking in. I don't do pricing accuracy in because they don't have devices, and I only have time right now to get around to all the businesses with devices.
Let me put this another way. What's the work you're not getting to that you should be getting to?
Okay, the pricing accuracy, package checking, making sure the packages have the correct amount or volume in them. I haven't been able to do any of the microbead inspections. Well, I can't say that. I have done some spot inspections when I'm in a store. I'll go through the cosmetics aisle and pick up 10, 15 packages and check them as I'm walking through. But it's primarily the package checking and pricing accuracy. And I could probably put somebody to work full-time just doing package checking because there's so many different types of packages.
Okay, thanks.
Peter.
Yeah, the thing that interests me the most is the difference between the half-time and the full-time. It's clear to me we need someone. And I'd like to ask you to repeat once again why the advantages would be to hire a full-time person now. I mean, I can see the argument against that is that, well, there won't be all that much to do. But what is the argument for it? I mean, what I see as the important point is a very important point of the making a full-time person was that if you were to die, a full-time person could take it right over. There's no training whatsoever.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, if you probably aren't going to retire for another 15 years, then maybe we don't. So I'd like you to address that question, the pluses and minuses of a half and plus, okay?
You covered most of it. It's a succession plan. I'm hoping to retire in roughly about 4 years. And like you said, if I unexpectedly get sick, there's absolutely nobody to take over, nobody to fill in. The full-timer, my concerns about having a part-timer versus a full-timer, it's a part-time person. Most of your candidates might be retirees or something like that, somebody who's just interested in a part-time, short-term job. Full-time person would be more likely to stick around for when I do retire. Then they'll be fully trained and step right in my shoes, which is essentially what I did. I was hired roughly 5 or 6 years prior to my predecessor's retirement. And I was able to just step right in and continue on with what I was doing.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a comment of my own that if we make it a full-time job, that doesn't mean it always has to stay a full-time job. I mean, for instance, when you retire, we have to rethink that question as to whether we ought to have a half-time or full-time. So mm-hmm. I'm convinced. Okay.
Mike.
Don made the point that I would have that basically with a small department like this, and he works very hard, it's very difficult to have if you don't have someone to back up on. And that's what happened when Judy Tinnick was the in charge, and Don came on to assist her, and that allowed her to eventually retire out. This department, we often smile because it's only a one-person department, but it's really our only consumer protection employee that we have. We have a lot of very honest businesses, but from time to time, their suppliers or others may not have given customers what they were supposed to in their packaging and other things. And I think it's we've kind of chugged along here with one person, and I think it's important. We've talked about this for at least 10 years, going up to another person. So I think we ought to have at least the halftime person.
Martha.
Well, I, you know, in general agree with that, but let me just check. So you say package checking. Mm-hmm. You know, I eat Honey Bunches of Oats, and it comes from, was it Post or whoever. Do you check those packages to make sure they're weighed correctly? I mean, that that's the right weight
from
in the
postal offices? No.
No, no.
No.
That, you know, a cereal box. That
yeah. I'm supposed to. I've actually done one complaint so far. Was heavy cream. The gentleman called, complained that the heavy cream was underweight. Sure enough, it was. But it wasn't far enough underweight that I could order it off sale. I had to go in, open up three packages, dump the heavy cream out, clean and weigh the empty dry package, and then get a tear weight. And then I could go through the rest of the cooler and weigh all the rest of the packages to see how many of them were short weight. So that's an example. Anything from vitamins, the count of vitamins in a bottle, up through to steak and lobster, you know, I have to verify that it has the right volume, weight, or count.
Right, but so I can understand that for something, say, burned dairy, or, you know, there's not a national weights and measures that does burned dairy.
No.
Or, you know, but you don't have to do national, products that come from, yeah. You have to do all of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't somebody else? Well,
they're self-regulated. They're supposed to make sure the packages are accurate when they leave their processing plant.
First and last line of defense, Martha.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I guess that seems wild. All right. It just occurred. All these years, I thought. All right. Let me ask you another question. Like. Jay was just talking about hiring somebody and sort of to start filling in when in preparation for retirement. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we fund this position and you're talking to potential, you know, candidates, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are looking for part-time work as well who would be interested in moving up to full-time within a couple of years. So I assume you just said in a public meeting you plan to retire in 3 years. It's not a secret. So
3 to 4, yeah.
So that could be part of the, you know, the package when you talk to somebody, you know, if things work out, like looks like, you know, I'm getting ready to retire. So mm-hmm. without a firm promise, but that's kind of part of what you would say when you're recruiting somebody, correct? Okay.
Carol.
So I had two things. One, I'm trying to remember. I can't off the top of my head. There have been at least two things in the past few months or over the last year that we here have said, boy, we wish we could do that, but we can't add that to Don's work. One had to do with the microbeads maybe and actually going to the public, maybe working with Marcia and writing some articles and you know, creating posters, letting the public know that the microbead thing was an issue. I think that's true now with it. They just did something with soaps. So it does occur to me that there's probably more consumer protection that we have wanted to do that. So are you envisioning hiring somebody who might have the capacity and time to develop a little more of a program in actually telling the public what their rights are than we've been able to do. That was one question.
Okay. When the neighborhood notification law was passed, I did that. I went around distributing flyers to the businesses that actually have the products that are restricted so that they would notify their neighbors. So I try to do that when it gets slid my way.
Okay. So there's probably work that we are not doing now that we could be doing that would be a public service. And the other has to do with hours. So have you increased how many hours a week are you working? Have you increased them over the last number of years in order to handle the extra?
I've been full-time 40-plus comp time.
Okay. And would you have any willingness, in order to make this transition, either this year or in future years, to start reducing yours, which would give some budget relief?
Excuse me. That's not an appropriate question at this point. Okay. It really is not.
My thought for other legislators is if there were a way to juggle.
I understand that completely, but you are now talking about to a department head reducing his hours to do something else. This is not what we do here, okay? If you want to ask him to reduce his hours, you need to talk to him one-to-one.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'd like to do at least some more than what he's asking, than what's been given. I'm sympathetic to the notion that it would be good to find a way to hire somebody who has the capacity and interest in becoming full-time if we're facing in 3 or 4 years having to move somebody in and we possibly untrained.
Loveland.
I'm willing to work with you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Y'all are some funny people. look, we all have been dealing with this for a while. Don, I thank you for your forward thinking in terms of, from an HR perspective, in terms of just, I'm going to be leaving. What's going to happen? You're a one-man operating machine. Mm-hmm. I sat on committees where we have talked about doing collaborative or I don't remember what kind of work it was with Cortland County, all kinds of ways we try to figure out how to add what's needed in this department. And it's just about time that we bite the bullet and do what's needed because clearly, Martha, I appreciate your question because I'm not sure who else does not know the amount of work that Don has to do by himself. And Mike, you're right. It's our only consumer protection department. I want to know that my potato chips, when it says it's 13.5 ounces, it's 13.5 ounces. And you have to go out and do it, or gasoline, or all those things. You went through explaining all of this many years ago several times over. So I personally would like to see this be a full-time position, and no, I would not ask you to reduce anything. That would not be the right thing to do. You're already working 40-plus hours to make this happen for our consumers. So, we all should probably be looking at a way to make this a full-time position because we've talked about it for how long have I been in this body? 15 years? 15 years now. So let's just do what we need to do here.
Yeah. Anna, last question.
Just a comment. When I came on to the legislature last year, it was the day before they voted on this, and this was the one big discussion argument that was still happening, and it really stuck with me. I think it was the one thing, and I just remember thinking, oh my gosh, when he comes back next year, I certainly will support him. So I really appreciate you coming, and I do understand that it's pretty much anything that is sold is under your purview, no matter where it comes from. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Let me just remind you all, and I have you both. We had the head of DSS in here the other day. They did a four-minute presentation of their budget. They have 211 employees, and we had about five questions. Julie, you're next. Go ahead.
I hope we can have DSS back, too. What I wanted to say is that the EMC is very interested in having neonicotine pesticides outlawed in this county. Emerging science keeps showing that they really affect the bee population, and that's a serious problem. But the EMC is not going forward with that because our weights and measures person can't possibly take on another task. So they will be very happy with this. And this is the first time I've ever heard legislators clap when Joe went through his budget and said he was recommending adding a half-time position. That was wonderful. It should be full-time.
Peter, I'm sorry. Dooley, are you finished?
What?
I wanted to let him know there's more work to do.
Oh, all right. Yeah, please keep working 40 hours a week. Peter, go ahead.
40 plus.
I'd like to say that I have only one. I've only heard positive arguments. I've got a negative argument why we shouldn't hire anybody. The number of times when I have said, we have 27 departments. They range from somebody with departments with 250 people to departments with one people. And I'd get huge amounts of laugh. No longer would I be able to say that.
You want a little lease program or what?
Do you have a question? Or are you?
I have a question, yes. How many hours a week are you asking for this position to be?
I've requested 40 hours.
Thank you.
We're done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
ITS. No OTR request, and here we go.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So thank you for the time. Lauren Cottrell and myself are here to present the ITS budget this evening. Pretty straightforward, we hope. First off, in the overview compared to last year, you'll notice that there was a slight increase in the fiscal target recommendation. That is a result of the negotiated salary and fringes increases in the department and one minor adjustment with the revenue that we've received from the probation department in the past. There's a slight amount that we decided not to do a direct billing from them since they were not receiving state reimbursement, so we just buried that in an increase in our fiscal target, and the same amount was decreased in their fiscal target. Slight change in the increase in the revenue, which is the result of the Soil and Water Conservation District being included in one of our facilities at the Public Works Department. So they've joined our forces for the Office 365 and phone services, and that represents that difference of $3,030. So now on to major influences for us in the succession planning for ITS continues to be an effort that we're looking at and need to focus on. We've gotten through one of the critical positions in the past year, but we've got two more to go in the next 3 years. One, it definitely will occur in 2017, and the second position is probably going to be 2019 time zone. That 2019 position is one that is critical to us, and we've got a plan for that in the next year and a half, and started thinking about that and reorganizing some of the duties and responsibilities of the department to make that happen. The second major influence is the continuing rollout of the Microsoft Office 365 project, and I will let Lauren address that in particular.
So as you all remember, we rolled out Office 365 this year. We changed your email, and we also rolled out new Office applications to a lot of departments, upgraded to Office 2013 or 16, and we're just going to continue that deployment throughout the county. We're also looking to change our server software subscriptions to the Office 365 model, which gets us on a more of a regular budget versus buying it just when we need it. We also have some fine-tuning to do in our e-discovery process. We just recently had our first FOIL request over Microsoft Office 365 on the new email platform, and for me it was a lot easier versus what I went through in the past. I'm not sure if that was the same for Joe, but it was easier for us. We also have a lot of work to do with data loss prevention, HIPAA protection, mobility, connectivity, teaching people how to use OneDrive, et cetera.
The third item on the slide is policies and procedures. That continues to be an area that we're going to focus on. We've gotten through two in the past year, social media and acceptable use, and we're starting to implement the change or the focus on account management. So we've issued an electronic form that we're piloting right now with two departments that allows departments to submit changes based on statuses of individuals and the access to either systems or data that they have right now. So that's all being documented and changed. Once we have that in place, then we'll follow through and pilot it and test it, and we'll follow through with a policy and procedure that is in the administrative policy manual focused on that. That's one of the critical areas for us and the work that we've done with the comptroller's office at the state. That's like one of the majority, the biggest area that the state finds faults in audits is the account management and identifying agencies that fail to remove account accesses and privileges for either employees that have changed status or have left the organization. So that's a critical one that we're looking at. Electronic signatures has become a really big hot topic for us, and what defines an electronic signature is all over the board these days, and whether that is, you know, I'm going to use my fingertip to generate an electronic signature, or I'm going to type something in that looks like an electronic signature, or it's the associated account access that you have with an account in a system, or it's a higher level of an electronic signature that is in use in many places these days, which validates an account based on a third-party organization. So we're trying to define that a little bit more carefully in the systems that we use both internally and respond to externally. So hopefully that will be coming. And the last one on the list is data classification and security. And that's another topic that we talked about with the State Comptroller's Office. So we have to do a better job, and we're working on it now, but we have to tighten that up a little bit more clearly about defining what data is available publicly versus what is classified on the other extreme, which is confidential, and what do you do with all this stuff in between, and how do you organize it, manage it? So that's another strategy that we're looking at taking. Shared services initiatives continue to be successful, and there's a lot of work and focus on that. The Let's Group for Law Enforcement Electronic Technology Shared Services Group is doing well. That project is moving forward. Less of our time these days, but it's still moving forward and generating a lot of our time and attention. The TESER, which is the Tompkins Shared Services Electronic Repository, Records Repository, is taken off and is really been very successful with the local jurisdictions and also within county government. So we're spending a lot of time responding to that project. And I only see that as continuing to get bigger and growing more, relying on more as we move into electronic forms that we'll talk about here in a second. And the GIS, or Geographic Information Systems, has recently accepted new members in that group, which includes Bolton Water District and the Swollen Water Conservation District as well. So we're trying to join resources to that. In addition, we've recently done an implementation of a dark fiber connection with the town of Ithaca for another project, for the TESER project, so that opens up their ability to gain access directly to their GIS data on our network as well, which is likely to happen. The fifth item I'm going to pass back to Lauren.
Okay, the replacement of core routers and data centers. We're going through basically a core infrastructure refresh. We just got done replacing our firewall, which allows external people in and us out to the internet. We're looking forward to replacing our core routers that we have two, one in our uptown, one in our downtown data center that communicate between the two. We hope in the refresh that we'll be able to increase our bandwidth from 1 gig to 10 gig. Right now it's somewhat of a bottleneck for our uptown location, public health, the Department of Emergency Response, Sheriff's Office. So looking forward to increasing that bandwidth. Most of the equipment is 10 years old. We've probably used it a little longer than we should, so now is the time. We're also getting some new equipment to help with redundancy, a product called FatPipe, which helps with internet redundancy so that with our 24/7 operation with public safety, if one of the internet connections goes down, we continue to work. So that's basically it.
The next item, business automation and electronic document management, is an area of the IT world for us that has really taken off in the past year. Most software these days comes with a prepackaged ability to define electronic processes behind software. And so it's not just managing data anymore, but managing processes, and that takes a lot of configuration work and coordination with the departments and the vendors that do the work. And that's another task in the IT role that we've taken on through the Smart Office initiatives is where it started. And we've seen a lot of great benefit in doing that. LaserFish is an example on the software that we use for the document management system that has really saved us a lot of time and effort in presenting electronic forms and review of what gets submitted to those forms. But it takes time and effort for somebody in my office to work with the departments and to define that more specifically. That ultimately leads to the collection and the storage and the management of the data. So we've done that for some critical county functions, including the FOIL process, compliance for that. We're working on a form right now for Title VI. We've done it for vacancy requests. We've done it for account management. A lot of internal stuff that used to be generated on a piece of paper are now going to electronic forms that we're devising and working with departments, and the output of that would be a static document from a records and electronic records perspective. The last item on there is the expanding emergency response role that we've had. We're involved in the Spillman project about five, six years ago right now, since we've done it. Kim Moore from my staff has been directly involved in that and working with the law enforcement community. But emergency response is a very high IT-intensive operation. I mean, it's very critical to the functions of county government. And as the role of emergency response evolves, the technology becomes critical to supporting that. So the question in the future for us and a major influence that I've talked to Lee about, and we've had meetings for the past 6 months about this, is what would be the necessary role of ITS in that program to support it in the long run? Because as that technology advances in their field, it's very difficult to train somebody directly at the level of IT support that needs to be done, particularly since they're so integrated with the county's network. You can't separate the two any longer, and we're probably seeing that more and more often as money is spent with emergency response and new projects are proposed. So those are the major influences in a quick summary. There are many more, but we'll stop there. The level of positions remains the same from last year. We had, just looking at the numbers for the difference between 2014 was really the increase was a consolidation of existing positions in the county that were from other departments that were centralized in IT. And then we dropped a half-time position due to retirement and absorbed that workload in this past year.
Questions? Martha, I saw your hand. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Lauren. Go ahead, Martha.
Yeah, thank you. Lauren, you said something about, I guess, the core routers or something was 10 years old.
Core routers, yes.
When you replace equipment, I'm looking for, you've got a budget for capital equipment. I see page 146. Is that where that comes from? I mean, is it?
So we've got some leftover funds left over from our voiceover IT project that we're going to dedicate to part of that. Yep.
So it kind of bounces around. You got 2014 was about 16,000, 2015 was 47,000, 2016 was 24,000, this coming year is 29. So is there any predictability to it, or is it?
Are you talking in our network components line?
Well, just other capital equipment. That's.
So this particular project is coming from three different sources.
No, I'm just kind of making a general. It's a general question about when you replace stuff. You're not replacing paper clips. Your stuff costs a lot of money. Yeah. So how's that?
Well, to be honest, a lot of the time we replace the stuff with grant money. Comes into our office mostly from the county clerk's office, so we try to leverage that money that comes in, and whenever we can do it with grant money, we do.
Okay.
It varies every year. So the core switch project is a project that we've planned for and budgeted for, and it's coming from various sources. So you'll see that numbers change based on the circumstances from year to year and what we plan for the replacement.
Okay. And then you mentioned that Bolton Point and somebody else joined the GES.
Soil and Water Conservation District.
Oh, okay, GIS. So I go to the fees, and I see that's page, appendix A, page 10. So I see that you charge per hour for private organizations or public and nonprofit work under GIS. So if somebody, Bolton Point joins GIS, that means that they then would be eligible to have you do work for them at $25 an hour?
Mostly the joining of that group and the MOU that we signed with Bolton Point allows them to use a system that we've already invested in for them to do their own work, to gain access remotely, to configure their online mapping applications to their needs. So we provide some assistance, but not necessarily at the level of we do the work for them.
Okay, so they're doing the work,
yes.
But we're providing.
So we charge them a rate which is designed to contribute to the software maintenance agreement that we have and the hardware to support those efforts. So instead of a local taxing entity going out and recreating and reinvesting local money, we try to offer that up as an alternative.
But it's also, it's not free for them to just come in and
that's
use
correct.
that asset. Yeah. Okay, just one other thing. TEASER, which that's a good acronym. Tompkins Shared Services Electronic Repository, what?
It's Records Repository.
Records Repository.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Will.
Thanks, Jim. Greg, several months ago there were big news stories about ransomware and how major institutions were suddenly being attacked. And I recall that you, in response, put out some advisories to staff, whatever. Have there been any new developments, and are you feeling that we are now, do you have the resources basically to adequately protect us against that?
Yeah, I'm going to pass that one up to Lauren.
Yeah, so it's a constant battle, just like viruses and malware. Ransomware is kind of the new thing. The idea that not everybody knows is that it's basically like a virus on your network. They encrypt your data, and then they hold it hostage until you pay for it.
Or
key.
You get a little closer to your mark.
So, you know, we part of the upgrade of firewall that we just put in, the security with Office 365, and a lot of times the ransomware comes through as an email attachment. And there's been several counties around the state that have been hit by ransomware, and it's a major deal. So do I think we're 100% protected? No. Do I think we're in better shape than we were maybe two or three years ago? Yes.
The other point on top of that is that we do something that are known as snapshots. So if we were impacted by ransomware, instead of reverting to a copy on a backup tape, we can just replace what's there from an hour ago or 2 hours ago. We do snapshots every hour. So if the data is modified, we do incremental snapshots on the devices that we have that stores our data network.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Anyone else? Mike, sorry, go ahead.
Talking about this emergency response services, I think what you were talking about is overall in EMS about ERS, like it's communications equipments and things that you're trying to bring together. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, the complexity with that level of service is that you have so many different levels of systems, and they all have to work together and interface together to be successful. You may have a department that relies on a single piece of software, but in the world of emergency response, you have many, many interfaces with the software that they use or the radio systems that they use or data that goes to the state or is being collaborated with the state. And so in the middle of that is a system that is based on the way that we've designed our network at the county level. So they've instead of them developing their own network, we've based their foundation based on the county network. And so as we evolve in virtualization and storage area network devices, they have to as well. And so their world of a static, isolated server needs to move or is likely to move into the world of virtualization. And in order to make that jump, it's a much more intensive IT requirement than they've had in the past. And our involvement with their vendors becomes much more complicated in order to get them there. So the role and the overlap between IT support from traditional IT support from emergency response and where we're going as a county needs to be reevaluated because, in my mind, they are getting closer together. They can't be separated any longer.
Okay, I understand that. I have one other question. On the campuses, when there's an emergency situation, the administration can send out a blast to all the kids' emails and all the faculty phones and all of that. Do we have any capability like that? If we had a situation in a particular building, for example, are we able to send out an emergency notification?
We are evaluating software in our phone system right now that allows us to do that. So whenever a 911 call is placed, for instance, right now, from any county phone on the ShortTel system, a screen would pop up on dedicated locations in county government that would tell us that a 911 call was placed. So yesterday morning, there were two calls placed to 911 from county phones. And so immediately on my screen, I saw the result of that. And so the question now is, how do we as a county government respond to those circumstances? The technology exists, but the management of the people to help with that circumstance is the question, and how to organize that.
Thank you.
Carol.
What would it cost us, or do we have the capability now, to use these fancy connections that we have sitting on our desks here be able to plug something in and show each other something on our computer screens or the public if they were here?
As far as your monitor or just presenting?
Or? Yeah, if I had a computer with me and I wanted to show everybody on the legislature and the public something or, you know, or for us to work on something together that with our computers plugged in.
To display here?
To the display, yeah.
Or share between computers.
Yeah, we can make that happen. There's several like we're connected here. There's several of those around the table, or at least a couple of them.
Yeah, I have one in front of me.
And so, yeah, you can plug in with your HDMI connector off of your laptop and do the same thing we're doing here.
Without us it costing us anything.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both very much. I'm going to amend the order a little bit and have finance begin theirs, followed by solid waste, the DA, and then we will have the ledge at the end.
Oh, well, they're switching, Jim. Oh, I guess they need Kevin.
What?
I have a question for Kevin. About
Kevin,
the
Carol has a question.
Well, when he's...
go ahead.
So, in past years, at some point during this process, we've gotten various iterations of these one-line charts with a summary of all... Sorry, I can wait. A summary of all the OTR requests on, you know, each one on one line with, you know, the, what was asked for and what was recommended, and then a blank line until we start filling it in.
That multicolored masterpiece you have in front of you is the product of one Joe Mariani, and I believe he would be willing to, we could probably work together to get that printed for next time. I think, Joe, is that a fair statement?
This was an older one, but, you know, I had, last year's was smaller and I had trouble reading it. But this one was for the from the year before. Mm-hmm. It was color-coded. That's optional, mm-hmm. but to have them on one line. Thank you.
Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you for the time you've given us tonight to present our finance department budget to you. And I'd like to start with our expenditures, revenues, and net local compared to last year. Before I do that, though, let me introduce to you two key people in my organization. I have Donna Shaw here tonight, who's our new Director of Accounting Services, effective about a week or two ago. Donna, would you stand? And she's taking the place of Sharon Reagan. Donna's been here 22 years. Is that? Oh, okay. Quite a bit more. And we also have the Treasury Manager who runs the other half of the house in the Finance Department. That would be Melanie Merriman. Melanie, would you stand up? Mm-hmm. This is her first meeting tonight. Both of these individuals have worked hard on their budget. They've provided them to us as division head managers, which was a little bit different than we had it in the past. We've gone through a reorganization this year, which I'll highlight some of the things that we're doing differently than we have in prior years. But as division managers, they've taken full responsibility for their budgets, and they have put them together for us. We used to have one individual in the finance department that put the budget together for everybody in all the different units. So we have changed that a little bit. But starting tonight with the expenditures, revenues, and net local, you can see that our expenditures have come in slightly less than in the prior years. The revenues have come in slightly more, and so our net local recommended budget coming to you tonight, if approved, is actually $20,352 less if you look at the net local portion. So our budget is less than the previous year. I want to take a little time talking about the major initiatives. I always try to keep it to one slide because we got into two slides last year, took up a little bit too much time, and I wanted to go more quickly tonight to share with you. Some of these are things that are carried forward from last year. Others are new. But what you see here as our major initiatives, and I should say for 2017, this slide says 2016, but major initiatives for 2017 is to continue to pursue electronic processing of contracts through eGov. Now, you may be aware that we purchased a new software system that helped us to do two things electronically, and that is to do our bids and bid awards electronically, and that's through Lisa Hall, our buyer in the purchasing division. And the other part of that software gives us the ability to do all the contracts electronically across all departments and agency. That heavily involves Jackie Kipola in the administrative office under Joe's authority upstairs. And so we're now just bringing that contract feature up to speed. It's taking a lot of effort to get the existing contracts all loaded into this electronic format. And we're hoping that when this is complete, we're going to be able to get rid of a whole row of file cabinets in the finance department, which, as I get further along tonight, you'll find out that that's fairly pretty much necessary, because we're going to be bringing in another workstation, another employee that we need to find space for. But those file cabinets that are dedicated to contracts, we hope to be able to do away with in the next 2 or 3 years. This project is not just one that involves the finance department. It involves heavy involvement with ITS. They just left the stage moments ago. But in that electronic processing of contracts, it involves administration, finance, ITS, and really all the other departments and agencies that are going to be using that system. So that's a fairly large project. Spills over from last year. We'll be spilling over into next year again. Number two, we're going to continue to roll out the Time Force electronic timesheet input. This was begun about the time I was hired 3 years ago. We still have not yet brought all departments online with the electronic way of filling out a timesheet. So we still have some departments to go, and that's a continual process. Again, it heavily involves the folks in IT, and it heavily involves our folks in my department in the payroll division. Number three, we want to interview and hire one employee to replace a current administrative assistant four that will retire in 2017. In a minute, I'm going to tell you where we are at in hiring the replacements for the current year. If you remember what I brought to you last year, I was telling you we were having what Jay was fearing was going to happen in 2019 has already happened in finance. We have a mass reallocation of resources for new employees, because out of the 13 positions that are in the finance department, we have 8 changes in the current year. So 5 people will be doing the same job they've always done before. 8 people will either be new or transferred in or trained from doing different duties in some other job for the county. So that's where we're at right now in 2016. We're in the midst of hiring 8 new people, or some of them are not new hires, but some of them are transfers. We have one that lingers on into the next year, and we had to budget accordingly for that. That one new position for next year, or 2017, is over in the Treasury side, and it's Lori Parker, who has been here for a long time. And she'll be leaving, and we budgeted, you'll see it as an OTR, we budgeted for 8 weeks of salary for the new position to take place while the old position is still here. So we have that dual coverage or double coverage, kind of like we budgeted for this year when we had quite a few different positions open. So that's what I mean in number three there, where we have one more position that's going to be a retiree in 2017. Number four, we're going to continue working on procedure manuals. We made good headway this year, especially with some of the key division managers leaving. We've gotten some good written materials started. We still need more for cross-training purposes. So when you see procedure manuals, I'm not talking about policies that would be coming forth to you, the legislature, although we do have some of those to redraft also. I'm mostly talking about in-house working procedure manuals. And number five, we would like to begin work to put into place acceptance of credit card payments in the office, to be able to accept those payments in the office and online. And that will take a bit of a legislative discussion, because I put that in there as an OTR. It's not been approved. And so we can still have the discussion and start talking about whether we want to do this or not. Joe remembered a point in time, which goes back before when I was here, when the legislature did have something to say, whether they wanted us to even go in this direction. And rather than take the time tonight and make that discussion, which we really don't have time available for that, I wanted to at least get it on the radar that we are asking for the ability to be able to do this. Whether the legislature wants us to take credit card for tax payments, you can decide that at another point in time, but I wanted to at least get that before you tonight. And lastly, we continue training, cross-training, organize the newly hired staff. As you can see, in 2016, we're at 12 employees, and due to the reorganization that we've done during the middle of this year, we actually increased positions to about one FTE, but it doesn't amount to a whole FTE because through the reorganization process, the two division managers here have reallocated the resources so that instead of 40-hour-a-week job, we've reduced two to a 35-hour-a-week position. And we've also, while these positions were vacant, we also restructured those jobs so that they were at a lower rate of pay. So moving forward, we actually have a whole FTE added to our roster. And that happened, incidentally, when Melanie took the division manager position there in the Treasury Department. When she left, she had been working in a half-time position for the accounting side and a half-time position for the Treasury side. And when she left, that left two voids or two half-time positions. We upgraded those two half-time positions to full-time positions, but we did it in a way with the lesser hours scheduled and at lower rates of pay, in other words, lesser responsibilities, that we were able to achieve savings and come in with less than the existing budget. So we were able to create an extra position or two, but still stay within the confinements of our existing dollars that we had to work with. So they really worked hard. Of course, having some vacancies open for a while helped also, but they really worked hard to reorganize the department in a way and where we get probably a bit better coverage than what we've had before. And then when you're looking at that change where it says 0.85, that includes the 0.15 OTR that I'm requesting for the dual coverage in Treasury, where we're going to be covering that position for 8 weeks with two people. And that works out to 0.15 positions. So just to give you, before I exit the screen, I just wanted to let you know where we are with the 13 positions that we have right now. Out of the 13 positions, as I said before, five people, such as myself, are remaining in their position. So we have five people out of the 13 who basically are doing the same job as they did last year. Out of the rest of those, we have six new positions. One is Lisa Schott, who is administrative assistant on the Treasury side. Another one is Donna Shaw, who has been promoted to Director of Accounting Services. Another one is Melanie Merriman, who has been promoted to the Treasury Manager's position. Lisa Christian is being promoted to Payroll Coordinator. She's taking the place of Linda Halstead, and Linda's retiring September 24th this month in just a short while. Thank you very much. So Lisa will be taking the place, moving up in the payroll department to the supervisor's position. Jessica Holbert, brand new employee, has just been hired. She'll be coming on board as a payroll specialist. She starts next Monday, the 19th, and she comes to us from Tioga County as the supervisor. She was previously the supervisor of their payroll department. So we found a really great person, another great asset to bring on board to Tompkins County payroll. And lastly, Julie Fergus is a principal account clerk, and she started it in our accounting department, taking Donna's previous position, and she started in July, and she's been working out great. So these are the six new faces that we have that are either brand new or working in a promoted capacity, which leaves just two left and those are vacancies. We still have the senior account clerk vacancy that we have not hired yet. That's been open for quite some time. And we still have the deputy director of finance position. That has been open for the whole year, and we have not been able to hire yet. We've unsuccessfully advertised and looked at applications and could not find anything that was close enough to even bring in and begin the interview process. So that was unfortunate. We only got four. We're starting that whole process brand new all over again with personnel. The one OTR that we did have approved is on this screen, and this talks about the $12,050 for succession planning. The only other position that remains to be filled after this year is in February when Lori Parker retires on the Treasury side. This $12,050, and this, if you want more detail, you can find this on page 4-103. 4-103 is the actual OTR that gives the nuts and bolts to what makes up this figure. But as you can see, we're looking for about 8 weeks of dual coverage, and it covers the salary and the fringes for that position. And then the last OTR that was not supported in the county administrator's budget is $5,000. That was pretty much a guesstimate or a placeholder for us to begin work into what it would take to begin credit card payments collection for property taxes. And I did not know whether this would include equipment or software or scanners or readers or any of that. So we stuck $5,000 as a placeholder in that. And this has not been recommended for a number of reasons Joe could speak to, but I know the two primary ones were, A, what I talked about earlier, he wanted me to have a dialogue with you at a meeting in the future where we could discuss the pros and cons as to whether we even wanted to move in this direction, and I agree that that was probably wise. And secondly, that $5,000 was just a guess. I since have talked to two other departments who have implemented credit card payment systems into their daily operations. One is probation, who did it last year. One is the health department, who did it, I don't know, approximately a year ago. And I asked them what was their all-in cost for doing equipment, training, software, the whole nine yards. And they said zero. Their total out-of-pocket cost with the vendors that they chose to work with, and there's a number of commercial vendors out there, is zero. So I kind of overestimated it when I put $5,000 in there. But we have meetings. My division managers and I have meetings with our existing software company that does tax collection to find out what they need to bring to us to show us what we need to do a little bit differently. So there may be some cost with the software, and I don't know that. We were trying to have that meeting prior to this meeting, but it may be later. It's definitely going to be later this week now. We didn't get that cost figure from them. So there may need to be some cost on the front end with our existing software company. But just to bring this to your attention, we would like to go down this road. If I don't get this OTR, I'm sure I'll be able to find the money somewhere in our budget to cover this cost. Or maybe if I find out exactly what that cost may be in the next week or two, I could ask Joe to revisit this. I could ask you to maybe give me a reduced OTR of maybe $1,000. And that is the end of the formal presentation. I take any questions that you would have at this time.
Okay. I have Peter, Carol, and Martha. Go ahead. And Dooley. Go ahead.
Hi. If I heard you right, you had a job that has been open for a year and has not been filled. And I wonder if you've thought about not filling it. I mean, whether it's worked, whether it's been satisfactory.
There are two vacancies right now, Peter. And one of them has only been vacant for a couple of months, and that's the position that when Melanie left and took the division manager's position. And we haven't been able to fill that simply because we were filling two other positions right prior to it, and our plate was very, very full going through the hiring of these other six positions. So I have a feeling that one will be filled probably in the next in the next few weeks, a month at best. But one position that has not been filled, that has been the entire year, was a brand new deputy director position that sits underneath of me. We created that position brand new last year, and it's supposed to be the next finance director position that was orchestrated and brought together, and we have not been able to do that. But that's a pretty high-level position, and we need to take our time in doing that properly. Thank you.
Carol.
On the credit card system, how does that work? Is there a cost to accepting payments that way? When you pay in a store by a credit card, the store is paying a 3% or whatever fee. So would that fee come out of our property, whatever tax payments you're collecting? Or do you add to people's bills as they
Leslie,
pay
did
it?
You want to speak to that? Or?
No, not at
no.
all.
Okay. I thought, well, maybe she knows more than me on this, and I'll just let her take it.
That's all I know.
Both, Carol. The answer is both. There's two ways to do it, and we actually have the two examples that I gave you, probation and health. They do them just the opposite of one another. At the health department, the fee is included in the whole service and fee that they're charging, so they don't pass anything on to the consumer. It's part of the built-in fee that the health department has. And they're going to run that way for at least the first couple of years until they see how much flow they have in the program, how much volume, if they want to break the fee out later. And that's how their system was sold to them, was so that we, the county, actually eat the transaction costs. Probation, on the other hand, is exactly what you mentioned. There's a 3% fee. It's passed on to the consumer. When they do their swipe, you know, if it's a $25 charge, they charge 3% more. It could be different if it's – sometimes there's a flat amount if it's under a certain amount, and then it's 3%. For tax collection, they have yet another formula because they don't – because we're talking about much larger dollars. It's a different formula on how they get paid their administrative fee. But we would be looking at it as an add-on for trade.
As an add-on
as
to
an
people
add-on.
For
it
their
It definitely
convenience.
Would not be something that the county would be able to bear. It would be an administrative fee, either a flat amount or an add-on, which is very common and typical, as you said,
yeah,
as
I,
with commercial
I would
outlets,
hope so. And then can you just repeat what you said? Go back to the one about the succession position. Can you repeat what you said? What is this?
If you look on page 104, section 4103.
It's essentially having one person assisting a new person while they're in the job.
Yeah, on 4103, it's OTR number 27, and it says that the it's a $8,000 basically in salary plus fringes.
And for 320 hours is like how many months is that? Or
it's 320 hours or 8 weeks
it's
at $25.22 an hour.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
It's me. go ahead. Carol, you satisfied with that answer? Dooley, and then Martha.
We're looking at the page that you were just on, 4-103.
Yes.
You have OTR 27 and 28. You gave them both top priority. I thought one should be more important to you than the other, but you didn't distinguish among them.
It's a misprint. I'm certain it's a misprint.
Which is more important is my question.
It's a misprint.
Which one
no,
is more
it's,
important?
We only had two, and one of these was put together from one of my divisions, and the other one was put together they came from the same division, but it should have been priorities one and two.
The way they appear, one's on top and two is
yes.
next. Okay.
Yes.
So I looked at your memberships This is a very small figure, but I'm looking at Section C, page 2, where finance appears. And there's something called GFOA, mm-hmm. which had a big jump. And I'm wondering, did suddenly a lot of your staff join something?
This is brand new. Actually, we have never been a member of the GFOA, the National Government Finance Officers Association. I have always been a member for about 26 years up until coming here. We do have membership in the New York State GFOA, the Association of Government Accountants, the New York State, the Sampo Purchasing, and also the Treasurer's Association. So this was brand new, and even though it says $180 in the previous years, we have never expended those funds. And I'm still looking into whether it's the best choice to move forward with becoming part of the National GFOA. I've always been a member before, and I strongly support it because of the types of training materials that they send us, the online publication, the webinars, the conferences. I believe it's very vital. So we managed to beef that up and include that this year. And that $840 represents what it is for a county our size. It's based on the size of the population of the government entity. So when we used 180 before, that's what I was used to paying in a smaller government setting.
Okay, I understand. So you haven't actually decided if you're going to do that.
We haven't actually decided that we're going to go ahead with it for sure, but I would very strongly recommend it. I'd like to do that. As for the training for all the people in my department, you'll see that our overall training budget in general has gone up quite a bit.
I saw that.
And I wanted you to know that I feel strongly that, especially for the new people, that they belong to associations and that they now become able to go out and get certain certifications and they go out for conferences. We haven't had training in the budget for that for a long, long time.
The 6,500.
Page 4-101. The last part of that page is the tax advertising expense, which has gone to zero, and I wondered where you moved it to.
These two divisions, 1362 and 1364, were part of our reorganization, and we've done away with those units.
You don't advertise?
Yes, we do, but it's been absorbed into the 1310 budget.
I just wondered where it went.
Yeah, both of these, the 1362 and the 1364, we felt that was redundant. We couldn't find anything that forced us to keep these stray units going on indefinitely, and so we absorbed them into 1310.
So that is on page 99. And where would it be in the expenditures list?
Under local revenues in 1310. Does that look right, Donna? Yes.
How much are we talking about here?
Well, the local revenues in both 1310 and 1315 have gone up.
Well, how much? I mean, what's the number?
$4,000.
$15,000 in 1315. And
I rest my case.
And it's gone up about $140,000 in 1310. But those are amounts that came from out of the units that they were previously used. We just had all these stray units hanging out there, and we wanted to put them, the local revenues, into one of our two primary units, either 1310 or 1315.
Jim, I'm sorry it's not $1 million, but trying to understand how things have changed is what I'm...
No, Dooley, my point is that the department head says this is what they're doing, and they're streamlining their operation, and we should allow them to do that.
And
okay?
And we're not stopping that.
Right, I understand that. Martha?
Carol had most of my question on the credit card payments. Do you think it would improve payment, like timeliness, or do you think there is anybody who's not paying who would pay if they had credit cards? Or
well, there are pros and cons, which you can probably think of quite a few cons and quite a few pros on your own. The main con is what government has battled for the whole 30-plus years that I've been in, and whether should we have this paternalistic approach to where we don't let people, you know, use credit cards so because we're afraid they're going to get in debt. And for many, many years, a lot of people had that ethical concern that, well, we certainly don't want to have them charge their taxes on a credit card, because then you're encouraging people, sometimes the people who have the hardly any wherewithal to pay at all, to go into debt. And so for many, many years, people thought this was a wrong thing. But I can tell you on the flip side of that, people are going to lose their house. And we bend over backwards and kind, you know, with, at the foreclosure season, as you know, the 20, 30, 40, 50 cases that we work through to help people come up with ingenious ways to keep a hold of their houses. Almost every one of those ingenious ways involves getting money from somebody, getting a loan, going to their bank, borrowing money from somebody, getting a neighbor to pay, getting, and the installment contracts that we formulate with them also. So in one sense, the people are already at that stage desperate to keep their house. And I rather see sometimes somebody be able to use a debit card or a credit card and save their house rather than to lose their house. And that's the bottom line. And that's why I've gone from one extreme to the other. And that's the biggest pro, is that it will keep maybe 10% of the people to remain in their house.
Leslin.
Mr. Chair, my question has to do with the credit card portion of it. Is this just strictly designed, whatever you're pursuing, only for tax purposes? Do people make all the payments to the finance department for other things?
It would be for all the types of payments that we receive.
Okay.
Or most.
That's what it said up there. That's what I wanted to know.
Taxes is what people think of mostly, but right. It would be for different types of payments
that we
receive.
That's
Carol.
Do people pay us now with, what is it called? I didn't even know about this until a few weeks ago when my sister paid me with an online
Bitcoin
check. She goes into her bank account and she doesn't like to, she no longer writes checks out and puts them in the mail herself. Her bank does that for her. She orders the check and the bank sends it out. So instead of my getting the payment from her, it came from Chase Bank. You know, do people pay that way to us?
Do we have that availability yet?
Or would we know?
It's kind of like an ACH payment or electronic payment, but we haven't initiated that.
Well, we don't initiate it. It just shows up.
It's just a check. It's paper, they authorize their bank to send you a check.
Carol, as paper or as electronic?
Well,
how does it show
it could
you?
Be either one. Yeah. I mean, it's a direct deposit. No, this was a paper. But it didn't. She didn't have to go
in. No, Melanie's saying no.
Excuse me. Wait. Do you do that, Rick?
My thought process was that if people are wanting to pay by credit card for the convenience, you know, young people are outraged if you're asking them to go and actually write out a check and put it in the mail. They just don't do that. They're used to putting their credit card number online. But I recently discovered that there's an alternative, that you can get your check and they can do it online.
We have not done that yet, but I believe other people have discovered that also. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So his concern about not letting people get in debt on their credit card is when it might be a convenience argument I'm thinking about.
I want to pay my mortgage with with the bank taking it out of my checking account. I'm really happy doing it that way. I'm not going to pay 9% on a credit card if I don't quite make the full payment. Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Solid waste next.
Hello.
Hello.
Up and down here. Please. Okay. I'm happy to be here, and I will give a brief presentation.
So you can see that our recommended budget is about a little over 1% higher than in 2016. So I broke this out a little bit. I reported to you last year, and last year was a very unstable year, that recycling revenues were about half of what they had been 3 years prior. And we have continued. We actually started the year with the lowest revenue per ton in history. I am happy to say that in June we started to see an increase. We're still about 30% less than what had typically been. The interesting thing that happened, can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The interesting that happened this year around March was all of a sudden we started seeing garbage increase. And at first I thought, oh, this isn't good. What's going on here? We keep recycling more. Well, I learned that a private transfer station in Tompkins County had affected their customers, some of the larger commercial haulers, by some of their practices and their customer service, and that they were only charging a couple of dollars a ton more, I mean less rather. And so we started to see what was already in the planning unit as waste coming to our facility. So what did that mean? It meant that we were all of a sudden seeing an increase in disposal fees that almost compensated for the loss in recycling revenues. We anticipated that we'd see about a $200,000 loss in revenue instead of the $400,000 or $500,000 that we had seen in the previous year. So that, in a way, was good. And not only that, we were able to access that material to do our waste diversion sorting, the floor sorting we do, that allows for recyclables that come in, the wood, the electronics, or the scrap metal, which is definitely worth money, some cardboard, and that was a plus, so we could divert more material. On the expense side, I'll show you this later. Next year, we're looking at a reduction in labor that we already are seeing in 2016. We had two retirements in the administrative function of our department, and we were able to combine those positions and also reallocate some responsibilities to the financial people. And so far that has worked out well. There's a lot of efficiencies. We too take credit card payments, and we also we are just live now being able to take credit card payments for permits online, and we'll be doing that with other things. And that has really helped a lot. Our costs overall are flat, as you saw. We are not anticipating any program losses, and we are bringing you stable fees, both the disposal fee for residents and commercial will stay at $85 a ton. The annual fee will stay at $55 a ton. And we'll see how things go. Every year for the last 3 years, we've reduced the budget in terms of certain program adjustments, hoping next year will be the first year in a while that we don't have to do that. In terms of talking about our strategies, Joe and I did some brainstorming. We're looking for stability in our budget and programs, which we haven't experienced. And we're also looking at continually rebuilding our reserves. We are at the 10% mark now, but we've had to hold that. We've had to decrease program expenses in order to maintain that. We're going to maintain our current programs. We have seven program budgets that we
have for the $5.4 million. I will tell you that we are planning to add six. We have two more locations that we're going to add this year for drop spots for food scraps. Newfield is currently in the works. We recently did Brooktondale, which is a big success. Newfield is in the works. And Groton will be the last one that we do this year. We're adding two new drop spots next year to take the place of the curbside collection, which will come to an end in a few places at the end of the year. There's been quite a bit of notification on that. And then we're adding four more. It is just amazing to me. This resembles a lot of the recycling program that we had many years ago when we were getting going. We're continuously having people come in for the toolkits, which is the caddies, the bags, and the transport containers. The drop spot tonnages are growing. We're probably going to double what we did last year, which is incredible. And there's a lot of very, very positive reception for that program. We do it two ways. We're either at a location permanently with a shed to store our stuff and the totes, or we have a tow-behind cargo van that's decorated, if you've ever seen it, with the food scrap logo. And that is also, it's a mobile unit that our staff is driving around. So we are really going to be reaching out more next year to both the rural areas and some more locations, and looking for any guidance on where might you be interested. But we're also reaching out. We've developed a terrific relationship with municipal leaders with this program, which I think helps all of us, and it helps them. We work directly with supervisors and with highway people or just community people involved, like in the case of Brooktondale, with the community center. And we really enjoy that. We really enjoy hearing how things are going and being able to grow that program. We're also going to be growing our public space recycling. We have several already in various places around the county. The most recent one is at Stewart Park on the Waterfront Trail. Any fears we had of illegal dumping are unfounded. It's going very well, and we have several others. So that's something we're going to continue to grow. You've approved money for our capital improvements to the recycling center. That consists of paving improvements, buildings and building improvements, interior structure improvements, including the decrepit push walls for the materials. We're improving the lighting. A lot of the lighting needs replacement. LED bulbs will also be included, and a variety of other miscellaneous repairs. So that will be a focus. We're taking bids 2 days from now, and I'm expecting in October we'll come, if things look good, with an award of bid for that project. So finally, this is what the situation looks like in terms of our FTEs. You can see, I mentioned the decrease in staff that we're continuing. And that's really about all that I wanted to mention at this time.
Mike and Peter. Barbara, I'm sorry. Did you finish?
I am done.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, this is the
Mike
last slide.
Mike and Peter, go ahead.
I thought...
And other Mike and Dooley.
I was going to ask you how we could continue the food scrap, how much it would cost to continue that, because I thought for some reason it was going away, and then I see it in here. So
what's going away is the pilot curbside collection of about 1,200 homes in the city and in the village of Trumansburg. We did the pilot for 3 years to look at what those costs are, very exorbitant costs. And quite frankly, the way that really needs to work is like in Portland, Oregon. Every other week, garbage collection, weekly food scraps and the alternative every other week recycling. I'm going to be working with the city of Ithaca, quite frankly, and trying to devise a plan. We did have a conversation about it, but for 2018, because I think there's a real opportunity, as well as in some of the villages. I know Cayuga Heights is interested, and Trumansburg itself might be interested, but we are continuing with our drop spots. We currently have 9 around the county, and that costs much less. And it's a pretty rural county, and I think that there is benefit in some of the more populated areas, but it's got to be done by the hauler that picks up the trash and can make those changes. Thank you.
Peter.
Just to satisfy my curiosity, I've thought about this many times and never thought of an answer. What is the market force that has caused the recycling, mm-hmm. The prices that recyclers are paying us for the stuff that we recycle?
There's several reasons. One had to do with the fact that many, many years ago, the Chinese market began to dominate the domestic markets here in the U.S. So we were really at the mercy of an international commodities market. And essentially, they wanted more and more material. Then they started having their own supply. They began recycling. So the market was in a glut. And also, they became very particular about what materials they would accept. And a lot of the stuff from the United States was contaminated. We actually don't have that problem in Tompkins County. It's very good material. So they started driving the price down for those two reasons. And that's the main reason. There are some new markets developing now in the U.S. I mean, it's kind of a sad story in terms of how it all happened. But at this point, it's kind of surprising to the industry, actually, that the markets for certain materials like paper are actually getting better, because everybody thought they would be poor and we'd all have to adjust for it. And we're pretty much the only county in New York State that isn't charging customers to bring in recyclables, because of the way we have a very well negotiated contract, and the hauler can't charge us more money for taking these materials to the markets. So that's really the story.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was looking in Appendix B, which is contracts. You have lots of contracts.
Oh, as always, yeah.
I was curious about the Chamber of Commerce memberships, because that has varied over the years. Can you tell me what's going on now?
We just have a membership to the Chamber of Commerce.
Just one?
One membership.
Based on one person or our county's size?
I don't remember. There's way too many details. I'll have to share that information via email. I think it's based, actually, I think there's a category for government and nonprofits, and I believe that it's based on, I can't remember if it's based on the size of the solid waste department. It certainly isn't based on the size of the county. But I know there's others, like airport and others, that are members, so I'm not sure.
Well, you're an enterprise. So
yeah.
Yes. There is an arrangement that you have with the city of Ithaca in lieu of taxes, because you're located in
mm-hmm.
the city.
Yep.
And for our newer members, I thought maybe you could describe that a little.
Yeah, I certainly can. Pardon? I don't know. I don't have what you have. What line is that?
Appendix B, page 12, City of Ithaca.
Okay. Yeah, I know what that's for.
But it's the concept.
Yeah. When we were looking to site the Recycling and Solid Waste Center and arrived at the preferred site being in the City of Ithaca on Commercial Avenue, the City of Ithaca pushed forward a lawsuit to stop the project. Michael, and Mike remembers this, and so do I. And so as a result of negotiations for that lawsuit to be dismissed, the county and the city negotiated a settlement, and that settlement consisted of a payment in lieu of taxes based on all the criteria that are used to estimate what the taxes for a given parcel would be. So that basically continues to be sort of a forever thing. And Joe and I have talked about this. You know, that's, it's also been part, if I recall, of just overall discussions with the city in terms of payments of taxes, and we are the recipient of needing to pay that fee.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Mike.
I was just wondering, where are we in the contract with the operator of the recycling
center?
That's
a great question. I was really going to bring up the status of what I see happening in the next few years to be prepared for. We have three and a half more years on the contract with the operator, but more importantly, a year from October, we'll have a new contract for the curbside recycling. And you probably, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, we pay very low price for that curbside pickup compared to what's being paid in the state, in the country, and there is no question. I mean, we're anticipating, as we develop our draft five-year budget, that that's going to go up 10%, hopefully, not more.
Percent?
What percent? 10.
10%. And that's about $1 million contract. The other thing that we're going to experience is, so we have three contracts in the five-year planning period, and the third one is the cost for hauling and disposal of trash. And when we're talking about, you know, again, you know, $1.5 million for that contract, if that were to go up 10%, again, you know, between the two, that's $250,000. And then, you know, we're looking at, it's hard to know what's going to happen with the current contract because there's been a lot of requests for more money that haven't been entertained. So we have some things in terms of the expense side to look forward to. We also believe that we will finally be getting our money from the state for that DEC education grant. And we're closing in on that, to receive that in 2017. So what I'm going to do as we're still working on our five-year budget. We have a preliminary draft, but that information is going to go to the committee, certainly at the beginning of next year, so that we can ruminate on all of the pluses and minuses and get a picture of where we're going.
Martha and Carol, yeah. And Julie.
The food scrap collection is great. We go to there's one at East Hill, and it's terrific, especially the paper towels and Kleenex. I mean,
yeah,
that's a lot of volume. So it made me think about, like, apartment buildings and all, and I see on the contracts on page 12, you've got cubic compost, food scrap collection, yeah. Apartments, mobile home parks, et cetera. So it looks like in next year they will start collecting?
We have been doing that for a few years on a very, very small basis. We're probably going to – we're planning to continue that and add two more. Again, it's the same issue as the residential collection. Roughly speaking, I mean, you know, again, it's one of those decisions – that really needs to be made in concert with the haulers that are picking up. There will be picking up garbage, but I will tell you that there will be a ban. Whoops.
Don't get too close.
Ah.
6 inches.
There will be a ban. There will be a ban of food scraps, at least on a commercial basis and possibly on a residential basis. I believe based on following it will be about 3 years. In New York State. There's already a ban in Vermont, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and one other state
what
that slips
about,
me. A ban, meaning there's already a ban to prevent yard waste or electronics from going in the trash. And what is going to happen here that's happened in a number of other states is food scraps will not be allowed to go in the trash, depending on size. So most of these places, there is a ban for any generator or business that has roughly 100 tons or more in a given year. that has to be directed to either a composting facility or anaerobic digestion facility. And that's the direction. I mean, the state's definitely going to do it. And what they're working on now, they're doing it really well. They're actually working with some of the larger haulers. And what happened in some of these other states is there wasn't the infrastructure to bring the material, but that's one of the things that I'm working quite a bit on. We have Kewa Compost, and they have quite a bit more capacity, but I'm also working with the wastewater treatment plant because they're not ready yet in terms of being able to accept material for digestion. And I'm pushing hard for the biosolids to not be disposed of, which they're currently doing, and for that to either be land applied or perhaps we have a composting facility for that material plus, you know, food scraps. So this plan that we're putting together in our, solid waste plan that will be done by the end of the year to take care of and prepare us for that ban.
Okay, you jumped ahead of me, though.
Sorry.
It looks like, according to this, food scraps collection at apartments, mobile home parks, et cetera, starts in 2017.
I think what the story is there, and I can verify it, is that it was actually in a different line item. So, yeah, I think that's. I think it was in with the other material that Kewa Compost collected in the county with the drop spots and with the other material. But I can verify that easily.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Carol.
Wait, so on this last one, do I assume correctly that if there's going to be a ban on the larger users putting their food scraps into the solid waste stream,
yeah, I mean,
that they'll have to pay to have it taken away, or are taxpayers here locally are going to be asked to pick up the bill for them, for us to collect it and do something with it?
We're not in a position that we can collect those quantities, and nor would it be in our budget. The way that would work is, again, the haulers would make arrangements to bring the material either to the Kewa Compost or to the anaerobic digestion facility.
With the fee going directly.
So
to the
when
facility.
New York State.
There'll be a fee.
There'll be a fee on the users.
Correct.
Not just for the hauling, but would there be a fee that would.
Well, it depends on what segment you're talking about. As it relates to commercial, nothing's going to change. There's fees now, and there's going to be, there'll be fees for both the collection of waste like there is and food scraps. For residents, we've taken a leadership role, and I don't think it'll be mandated, but it'll be preferred. We've taken a leadership role in providing an opportunity for our residents to be able to bring food scraps to any one of these drop spots in the county.
You know, I understand that. I'm concerned about right now the haulers are due to get expanded fees, but they're hauling it somewhere. So are we going to be required under the terms of this new provision to expand our capacity to deal with the waste and the city of the wastewater treatment plant, or will there be fees on the larger users to expand their capacity?
Now, there's lots of elements to what you're asking.
Should we be weighing in?
But simply, the way the haulers currently have fees for disposal at given sites, they, again, like the transfer station at the Casella facility, or we could potentially take the commercial food scraps at our facility, which we applied for a grant to look at the possibility. There will be fees that haulers will pay by the ton for food scraps.
Great. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That. It's not that straightforward.
Yeah. Thank you. I have two questions about wages and revenues. On the wage end, are we making any further progress? Where do we stand in getting our contract workers up to a living wage?
We stand to be perfect. That's what we're doing. And remember what we did.
This year?
Every year.
Okay.
We remember what we did with the Casella contract. We require them to pay for living wages, living wage rather, and we also increase service opportunity for them to divert more material through reuse and a number of other things so that they would, we would be able to give them more work. And, you know, that meant they were getting paid more from the county, but there was also a gap. There's about a $25,000 gap that they have to pick up of the roughly $100,000 that the living wage increased their budget by.
Okay, thanks. And then
sure.
On revenues, a lot of...
And that's true with other contracts, too. Okay.
So yeah. All of the revenues, as you go through your budget on pages, say, in Section 4, come out as other revenues. It's over $5 million total, just as other. Can you either tell us what those are and, or go through the pages and tell us?
Let me take a
peek. So the solid waste disposal, it's other revenues of $1.6
right.
million.
Right. What that means is that's the amount of revenue that – that's the total amount of the budget in terms of what we need to fund, and that total is a combination of disposal fees and annual fees to be collected.
Okay, and then on the recycling, the other revenues, where do those come from? That's page
one,
section 4, page 255.
Yeah, so so you were talking about the full budget. Yeah, this is the part of the budget that's entirely funded by the annual fee, and it pays for that 8163, which is the recycling budget. So it's all annual fees. It's a portion of the 5.4 that you asked about earlier. So all of these, all of the programs that are funded by the annual fee add up to the total amount of the annual fee. What you don't see, which is probably why it's a little confusing, and I have that in my spreadsheets, is that 5.4 doesn't break out what the disposal... Oh, maybe it does. Hold on. Let me see something. Yes, it does. Well, it doesn't, but I can tell you that of the 5.4, the amount that's funded through disposal fees is on the next page, and that's roughly $1.8 million. So if you were to subtract 1.8 from 5.4, all of the other budgets in the following pages are the annual fee combined.
Okay.
You combine
except
all those numbers.
Grants, maybe.
What's that?
Except for grants, which might come out differently. So like on the solid waste
reduction,
that's also...
Okay. At least a dozen revenue sources that include grants and, all these little items, the recycling revenue, the grants, miscellaneous fees, selling containers, all add up to the annual fee. So you're talking about two different things. One is how much money are we collecting, and that's the annual fee. And then how much revenue are we including, and that's all of the different fees and how it makes up the annual fee.
Okay. Well, in future years, if there's a way to have such large amounts not just fall under other, but does our spreadsheet not allow?
So I have one of those. It's two pages. And from now on, we can, and for this year even, we can make sure to distribute that so it'll be really clear to you what's going on. I don't know. Yeah, we used to do that. So, and I have it sitting here right now.
Julie, go ahead.
Thank you. Is the leachate hauling used to be done by We Care, and now it's done by Gotta Do?
It's the same company.
Same company? Okay.
Yes, it's
Thank
the
you.
Same company. They're always buying each other out.
I need to ask you whether there is a radiation detector of any sort at the solid waste facility.
There isn't, and it's not required by the state. If we wanted to do that, it would cost a few thousand dollars because I looked into the regulations. I looked into what would be involved, and there could be. The material, of course, is, since it's a they're required at landfill, so the material that we transfer will all go through through the detection at the landfill, and they're very, very, very strict. But at transfer stations, it's not required because they figure it's going to go somewhere else, and they can identify the loads.
But it can leave its traces behind. So the reason I asked is that the state has many revised solid waste regs out for comment now, and some of them deal with this question.
Yes, I've read that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Have a good evening.
Yes. Next is the district attorney, district attorney Andrew, and then we will finish up with Ledge. Hello, Andrew.
All right, good evening. I'm Andrew Benavia with the District Attorney's Office. Thank you for allowing us a chance to speak this evening. With regards to the budget, we have just an increase of $98,288. That is almost entirely made up of the increase of salary and fringe benefits. We are obviously an organization that relies heavily on our labor costs. The $3,000 that's not part of that increase is our OTR, which I'll get to in just a moment. What I will say is I don't have a major influencers slide, but I'd like to discuss that if I could just briefly and let you know what the different impact on our budget is and, of course, on our labor costs. That's what makes up most of what we do. The first thing that I think looking forward is that there's been an increase in sexual assault reporting. That's been in the news. It essentially affects us in three ways. The first is there's been a lot more national attention drawn to that, which has resulted in an increase in the reporting of sexual assault cases. The second is that there's been the Title IX compliance requirements of the colleges, which has also resulted in an increase in the number of sexual assault cases that we've been handling. The other component of that is that sexual assault cases typically are the most time and labor intensive cases that we handle. When I first started about 10 years ago, we had one person that was dedicated to handling sexual assault cases. We've now addressed that increase by having two of the prosecutors, myself and another ADA, that handles that. I would expect in the coming future that that's going to continue to increase. The other area is there has been an increase in the number of specialty courts, and I think that's going to continue. There was the suggestion in the municipal task force that there be a DWI court. That, like all the other specialty courts, the integrated domestic violence court, the sex offense courts, that requires time from our prosecutors that they have to appear in those courts. We certainly support those courts, but that does take time away from when they can be doing their other jobs. The other component that we've been doing is we've started to work towards doing a paperless office, which is obviously a monumental task in any department. But we work a lot, obviously, with law enforcement agencies, and it is very heavily paper-intensive at this point. We're working with the Information Technology Services and the county clerk's office at this point to come up with a way to at least reduce the way that law enforcement gives us those cases, and to try to take away some of the paper burden that we have and that they have. So we've made progress in that area, and I expect that to continue. I don't think that we're going to reach a point where we're going to be entirely paperless, but we are putting efforts towards that. The other area is we have been working with the Stop DWI board to start undertaking the fine collection. When I started that about a few months ago, there was about $400,000 in uncollected fines. We've set up a program at this point to start the collection process. We've already, I think, got about $30,000 of those collections and fines, and we'll be dedicating a lot of our resources to that effort. And then finally, the other area that I think you may have heard about is the body-worn camera evidentiary requirements that we have started with the Ithaca Police Department. That's been a great success in terms of the evidence and using it to support cases and provide evidence to defense attorneys, it does obviously require an added level of energy and effort on behalf of the DA's office and the law enforcement agencies. I expect that other law enforcement agencies are going to follow suit and that they will also be using body-worn cameras in the future, and we will need to increase our handling of that evidence during the production of that from the police agencies. So those are some of the areas that we've been working on. You'll see with the full-time equivalents, we have not added anyone during this time period. Looking back, we did add half of a confidential investigator who has been an excellent help in our office in actually handling the body-worn cameras and working as a liaison between the different law enforcement agencies. He's a former police officer, and that's allowed not only us to use his services, but also the local police agencies as well to do that. The one-time request that the over-target request that we're asking for relates to the replacement of some computer equipment. I'm a strong believer that technology in the courtroom is very essential, and that I believe that's one of the reasons why we've been fortunate to have some success, is that we have been using flat-screen TVs and projectors to inform the jury as to what the evidence is, and I think that's what juries expect. We have been using two laptops in connection with those flat screens that are about 7 or 8 years old. They have served us very well, but they are obviously getting older at this point. So we're requesting as part of this two laptops that are $1,300 a piece. And then I'd also like to get the office on a management plan or a cycle for the computers that we have in the office, the desktop computers. So I'd like that cycle to start and revolve each year. So we're asking for two desktop computers that are approximately $500 each, and then one monitor that would go along to replace one of the very old monitors that we have. So that's essentially what we've been doing and what we're asking for.
Question for Andrew. Peter or Martha?
There was one thing that you said that sort of surprised me, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on it. When you said that the DA's office is going to be involved with the body cameras, and that surprised me because I would have thought that the police look at those things. I mean, the police do the investigations, and you prosecute. So I would think that facts, you know, like body cameras, would be equally available to both the prosecution and the defense. Is that? Am I wrong about that? Or?
You're not wrong about it, but we are essentially, at this point, we are the agency that requests the body camera footage from the police, and then that we have to put that in a form that's provided to the defense attorney. There is an idea that I support, and I hope that we can get to, that would involve essentially there being mutual access to a central cloud server by both the defense attorney and the DA's office. That's somewhat in the works, but what it requires is each defense attorney to have their own unique identifier that would then make that case's footage available only to that attorney, so that you're not having a situation where other defense attorneys can access footage that may not be relevant to their case. So I certainly hope that maybe down the line that will be something that will be much easier to do, and you can refer the defense attorney simply to a place on the cloud, so to speak, where they can access that and pull it down themselves. We haven't gotten to that point yet, but I think that's an idea going forward.
That sounds good.
Oh, Martha.
You said the stop DWI fines, you collected 30,000 out of, what was the number I missed?
The starting point was $400,000. That's essentially what the unpaid fines are. Now, there's different categories that each of those fines go into. For instance, one of the things that we've done is we've determined that there are a number of people that have deceased since the time of their fine, so obviously they're not collectible fines. There are some people that are in prison at this point, so we have a very reduced ability to actually collect those fines. And then there are persons that are located in Florida or Nevada, some state that's way outside of New York, and so that's another sort of obstacle. What we've tried to do is essentially provide as much notice to the persons that do owe fines at this point and to let them know they have the option of setting up a payment plan or to pay off their fines. So we've had some people that have come in and said, we want to start a payment plan. We've had some people that paid off their fines. And then we have some people that just have not responded to us. And so going forward, we have to address how to collect those fines.
Do we have, there have been a lot of stories in the news about people being imprisoned because they can't pay fines or they can't clear whatever the court charges there are. Does that happen here? I mean, I know there's bail, and if you can't make bail, you sit and you wait. But
you're referring to what people we commonly know as a debtor's prison, and no, that's not legal.
But a lot of communities are doing it.
We have not done that. What I can tell you is that we have not done that. And our plan, obviously, we want to collect these fines, and the plan is to try to give as much notice, as I said, and as much opportunity for somebody to collect that fine. There is a process by which a person who owes a fine can make an application to the court essentially saying that I'm not paying this fine because I have the money and I'm ignoring you. I'm not paying this fine because I don't have the ability to do that, that I'm indigent, I don't have the funds. So we would be required in the face of that application to say that's not the case. This person actually has sufficient funds to pay those fines. So there is a process that sort of acts as a gateway so that you're not just putting someone in jail just because they don't have the ability to pay.
Okay, but we don't, even if we believe somebody has the ability to pay, and we don't put them in jail because of that.
We have not gotten to that point where we have even brought somebody in and placed them in jail. There is a process by which you can request a warrant. In other words, if the person is not answering the attempts to have them pay, you can ask a judge to issue a warrant and to have that person brought into court and then address before the court this issue about whether they have the ability to pay. But we have not done that during this fine collection. We have not arrested anybody. That's not been part of that.
Thank you.
Billy.
Thank you. I'm looking at Section 4, page 81, which is the program summary page for you. And I don't understand the chart at all. Surely you had expenditures and revenues.
Right. I'm at 81. Yeah. What's the question? I'm sorry.
I don't understand the chart.
So I'm not sure you look at the right page.
It was zero last year and a bunch of money this year.
It may just be an error, but I think that...
Oh, okay. Right. So, I'm sorry. I was making sure I looked at the right one. This is the part of the budget where we describe exactly what we're doing. And in 2016, when that budget was done, there was not an attempt to provide a description of what that was. When I became involved in the budget process, this is my description of what we're doing and then sort of the location, the identifying numbers of where that goes. So as part of the budget process, I'm now adding that portion into our submission of the budget.
It's good to have a description. It's not unlike the earlier description, but... Surely there is money that should be attached for 2016, even if it's not there, and Kevin knows where it is probably.
Kevin.
This part of the budget had in the prior system and in this system, it depends upon referring and connecting new records with old. And this is the first time working with Andrew that we've had a report like this from the district attorney's office, and so there was no prior record to link it to. That's why the zeros are there.
All right. I tried to look at the consolidated budget and figure out what numbers belong there, and I almost could. So I thought you could do a better job than I could. Thank you.
I have the last one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think this is a question for you, then I have
Grab the mic, would you please?
Sorry. Thanks. I have a page 77 and a page 79 that I'm trying to figure out. Is there a difference? Is there something I'm missing? One says consolidated budget, the other doesn't, but it's the same information.
Yes.
Should I be looking for something different in it? Go ahead.
Kevin?
Our custom in the way the budgets are laid out are to provide both the consolidated budget, which sums up all the functional units that make up a particular department's budget, mm-hmm. as well as providing the individual functional unit. In this case, there's one functional unit, so it appears to be exactly the same stuff, and in this case it is.
Okay, thank you for that. And then my question, I don't know if it's you, Andrew, or the county administrator, revenues. Haven't talked about the fines. I don't know if there are other fines that come into the DA's office. I don't know what they're used for. But I don't see any reflection of that in the revenue lines. And I'm just wondering, is there a reason why we don't reflect even the $30,000 or any amount of other revenues?
That revenue, the stop DWI fines, they're not revenue to our office. That's part of the court fine that's usually distributed in the normal way through that. We believe that it's obviously a laudable goal to have those fines collected. Some of that goes to the stop DWI program. It's distributed not to the DA's office, but through the court system.
Thank you. That's my question.
Martha.
I think we just pointed to, Dooley, your question about what should be in 2016. That page we're talking about has those same numbers for 2017 and presumably 2016. Okay. Andrew, you said at the beginning the salary increase was about $98,000 and change. We had to increase the DA's salary. Is most of it that?
Yes. So
statutory.
That number is made up of the approximately 2.5% increase to all of the employees, and then it does include the increase in the salary to the district attorney's position.
Because we paid part of a year earlier this year when the salary was bumped up, right? Yeah. And then so this reflects the entire year at the higher salary?
It does.
Can you remind me what that is? Or maybe it's...
Just looked at it. And then I'll be able to find it. It's up to 183. I can't remember what it was in the prior year. I think it's up by around $30,000 altogether. Does that sound right, Andrew?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
this would be the first time you see this at all in the budget. That's why you see the full effect of that plus 30 in 2017.
Okay, so it's
$30,000
out of that 98. Is mandated by the state of New York.
At least, and that's not an exact number.
And that's used to be paid by the state of New York. Thank you.
And was that salary and fringe? Or?
Good point, Carol. That's only the salary piece of it. So there would be the, call it 50% fringe factor on top of that.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
And last bit. Not least, the legislature. And Ms. Covert is ready to go. Right.
Hello.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
I'm sorry?
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Kathy Covert, Clerk of the Legislature.
Thank you.
Okay, I have submitted a budget that maintains the current level of service. And we have no OTRs. And the full-time staff, we have 3 full-time staff and 14 legislators. But I would like to just provide a glimpse of the work volume of the 3 full-time staff in an average year. In addition to the many responsibilities, staff attends a minimum of 165 committee and legislature meetings each year, including preparing the agendas, minutes, and notes. Over 250 resolutions are processed and adopted. 3 to 5 and sometimes up to 10 local laws are adopted. And approximately 200 applications for appointment to advisory boards are processed. In 2015, we began exploring software options that would allow us to move from what is now a manual process to an electronic method that would also include options for a public web portal. We identified a software product that had the strongest likelihood of meeting our needs and worked with them until recently. For a number of reasons, including the uniqueness of the individual advisory boards, we've put that on hold. We believe there is a need to have a more standardized appointment process in place before moving forward with a software program. It will require looking at many of the associated policies, procedures, and bylaws. What we did learn over this time is that the process we currently have is thorough, accurate, and efficient. However, it is also reliant on the knowledge of staff with over 30 years' experience, with not only each of the boards and their appointment process, but also with the ways in which each is unique from another. It isn't practical to continue to rely on this knowledge, but to take steps to bring as much standardization and consistency as possible to the process.
That's all I have.
Questions for Kathy. Kathy, one comment. The things that you just said to us, do you have that printed anywhere?
No, but I can make copies.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, number of meetings, number of advisory boards. That's something that I have not known, and I think that's a good thing for us to all have.
And that was just committee and legislature meetings, okay. Not department head meetings and other meetings we attend.
I repeat, I think that's something we should, you know, that's the kind of knowledge we should have. Questions for Kathy? Hearing none, thank you very much. Oh, no, Martha?
When you say consistency to the appointment process, you mean you're going to be looking for some software? Or you have to go through all the board policies and bylaws?
Well, right now it's a manual process. You know, we're having to generate individual letters and, you know, just typing names and addresses numerous times, and it just would be nice to find a system that would make it a more electronic process.
Any estimate on how many drafts of all those 250 resolutions you deal with? Never mind, you don't have to answer that. Oh, here, I've got a really good one. You're all going to love this. In 2014, we had an other revenue of $15. How come we don't have that anymore?
I don't recall what that was.
Any other questions? Julie?
I'm looking at Appendix B, page 7. This is Accela? I don't know. How do you say it?
That's Accela, our meeting management program.
Yes. In the past, it had been $18,000 for that, plus $3,200 for software for the advisory boards. And I see that you have combine them together for this coming year. So it looks like you're assuming you're going to buy that.
It's the same company, but right now we've put that on hold.
But you do want the full 21-2 now. Yes, you do, apparently. Okay.
We're undecided at this point.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Yeah, is this where we deal with travel for legislators?
Yes.
So how has it been, you know, do we do okay in terms of being able to reimburse people?
We do. We stay within budget.
And we would have more to travel if we all reduced our salary by $5,000, and that would leave $70,000 that you could go wherever you wanted to. Nobody wants to do that? Anyone else? Kathy, thank you very much.
I'm sorry. There is another question. We used to... It's okay with me that we drop out of our membership from the Conservation Leaders Network for $45. But we used to pay a $900 membership to the I.O.
Dave and I would take umbrage of that.
What has happened to that?
What? Say it again.
What has happened to our $900 contribution to the I.O.? It used to be under this budget.
I think it's still in there, Dooley.
Really? Okay. I didn't think it was.
What is it? Is that like a LEPO?
The intermunicipal organization. It's all the communities around the lake.
It's
how many people know what a LEPO is?
Dooley, it's the Cuga Lake Watershed Intermunicipal. It's $900.
Oh,
and the answer is?
Still in there. It's under Cayuga Watershed.
Okay.
Okay.
That's the drinking water for most people in the county. Not me.
Which is
we need to look into that. I think that's an error.
Yeah. It's a different organization, but that's fine if we're actually giving it.
Anyone else? Thank you very much. Kathy?
Thank you.
I think we're done. My only comment is that the last person was supposed to be on at 7:10, and I added 20 minutes for the DA, maybe 7:30, 7:35. Check your watch.
Jim, can I
that happened, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead. The meeting is over.
Well,